Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident. And this is the 59th episode of the Divine Intervention podcast. And I'm actually pretty excited this morning. I'm going to be completing the neurology clerkship review series, right? So this will be part 8, and this is actually going to be the final part. Very high yield lecture, and I'll try to make it as short and as quick as possible, although there's lots of high yield stuff here. So we'll see how that goes. Okay, so the first slide, right? So it says a paresthesias in a patient who is being treated for TB. Well, I really hope you're thinking about isoniazid toxicity. Remember, you can prevent that by giving a vitamin B6, right? Which is also known as pyridoxal phosphate. And then the next one says paresthesias and loss of joint and position sense, okay? In addition to like lower extremity hyperreflexia in a patient with a 15-year history of poly-treated Crohn's disease, right? So I'm asking for the diagnosis, what kind of testing do you do, and how do you treat this, right? So this is obviously B12 deficiency, right? Remember, Crohn's disease loves to torch the terminal ileum, right? And that's where B12 is reabsorbed in addition with its intrinsic factor, okay? And remember that B12 can cause like a subacute combined degeneration of the cord, right? So basically, you screw up your dorsal column medial lemniscus system. It doesn't work. And then you also screw up the lateral corticospinal tract, right? So basically, if you have a subacute combined degeneration, you have like loss of vibration, fine touch, proprioception, right? And then you also have upper motor neuron symptoms, right? So like spasticity and like hyperreflexia, right? Because your lateral corticospinal tract constitutes the upper motor neurons for those lower motor neurons that you find in the anterior horn of the spinal cord. And I mean, there are many like surrogate tests you can use to diagnose B12 deficiency, right? I mean, like, if I'm not mistaken, you could potentially check a B12 level, though I'm not really sure about that. But I'll say classically on exams, right? They may give you a person that has like a macrocytic anemia. If you want to be a little more specific, they potentially have like a megaloblastic anemia, right? And they also have elevated levels of methylmalonic acid, right? Remember, if you want to convert methylmalonyl CoA to succinyl CoA, you need an enzyme known as a methylmalonyl CoA mutase, and that depends on vitamin B12 as a cofactor. And then there's this other test. Pretty much no one does it in the real world anymore, but it shows up actually quite commonly on MBMEs, okay? The Schilling's test. I mean, there are many steps, but it's basically like a fancy way of figuring out the cause of a B12 deficiency, right? And the thing you really do, and I'll give you like the Cliff's Notes version of this test, at least tell you what you generally need to know for exams. Basically, you inject B12 into a human being, right? You basically saturate every store of B12 in the body, okay? And then after you've saturated them with like IV B12, you then give them oral B12, right? Because everywhere is saturated, you expect to find the B12 that you just gave them in the urine. You give them like radio labeled B12, supposed to find it in the urine, right? So let's say you give the oral B12, you're like, wait, I'm not seeing any B12 in the urine. What's up with that? Right? I'll say there are many potential causes for that, but on exams, you probably think of two major ones. One is pernicious anemia, okay? Or another one could be that you have a disease in the terminal ileum, right? Classically from like Crohn's or like tropical spur, for example, okay? So the next step is you give them that radio-labeled oral B12, and then you give them intrinsic factor, okay? Radio-labeled oral B12 with intrinsic factor. And if that essentially, if you give intrinsic factor and you're like, oh, wait, I can see all this B12 in the urine now, right? You then know that you're dealing with pernicious anemia because the addition of intrinsic factor fixed the problem. But if you give intrinsic factor and it does not fix the problem, probably think about more of a terminal ileal disease, okay? And I'm not going to go into this right now, but if you have an absorption defect in the GI tract, you'll have something known as an abnormal D-xylose test, okay? So it's just one of those weird things you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind. And obviously, if a patient has B12 deficiency, you should clearly give vitamin B12, right? Okay, now next one says ataxia and hemolytic anemia in a patient with a history of A-beta lipoproteinemia. Okay, and a brain MRI is revealing cerebellar atrophy. This is kind of a weird one, and it's one that many people get wrong on exams for some reason, but it's actually kind of high yield. And this is actually a vitamin E deficiency. Okay, it's a vitamin E deficiency. Remember that if you have a beta lipoproteinemia, and please don't forget that's an autosomal recessive disease, you have a deficiency in something known as a microsomal transfer protein. I believe I've talked about that in a previous podcast, or I will talk about it in a previous podcast. So you basically cannot make ApoB48 and ApoB100, right? So you essentially have troubles like exporting like chylomicrons and LDL and stuff, right, to other parts of the body. And if you have those issues, obviously, right, you'll basically not be able to move like fatty products around, right? So like your fat soluble vitamins, for example, like vitamins A, D, E, and K. So that can cause a vitamin E deficiency, and vitamin E deficiencies can cause like hemolytic anemias. They can cause problems with the cerebellum, right? So patients with vitamin E deficiencies tend to get ataxia and whatnot. Okay, and please don't forget the association between A-beta lipoproteinemia and acanthocytosis on a blood smear. That's a very high yield hematologic association you sort of want to keep at the back of your mind. Now, the next one says mammillary body infarcts in a chronic alcoholic, right? So you're thinking of maybe like Wernicke's or something like that. But alcoholism, right, is classically associated with a B1 deficiency, a thiamine deficiency, right? So like this enzyme, transketolase, right, from the non-oxidative phase of the HMP shunt, also called the pentose phosphate pathway, doesn't work so well, right? So you can have like infarction of the mammillary bodies. And then the next question, let's see, there's so many things here. So dermatitis and dementia in a patient with a long history of carcinoid syndrome, right? So if you have carcinoid syndrome, right, you have a tumor that's secreting a ton of serotonin. Remember, that's usually the most common location is in the appendix, right? So if you have carcinoid syndrome, you're secreting a crap ton of serotonin. Remember that serotonin is also known as 5-HT, 5-hydroxytryptophan, right? So that tells you right off the bat that it comes from tryptophan. And if serotonin comes from tryptophan, right, if you have a tumor that's secreting a ton of serotonin, right, you'll see a ton of, you're basically diverting all your tryptophan to the production of serotonin. So that tryptophan will not be diverted towards the production of niacin, which is vitamin B3. So you can have pellagra, right, which is what this patient has, right, which has the four Ds, right, like dermatitis, diarrhea, dementia, and the bad D, which is death. And then also don't forget that if a patient has heart knob disease, remember it's like it's an amino acid, a neutral amino acid transporter defect. You don't reabsorb neutral amino acids like tryptophan, right? That can also go ahead and cause a carcinoid. I mean, that can also cause a pellagra, right? Because again, you're not reabsorbing the feedstock that you need for the production of niacin, which is vitamin B3. Okay, and remember the way you diagnose carcinoid syndrome is by checking for 5-HIAA in the urine, right? That's a metabolite of serotonin. Okay, now the next one says child with chronic abdominal pain and food drop who over the past 6 months has been performing poorly in school. Okay, that's not good. Right, so food drop, abdominal pain, this is a classic MBME presentation. It's pretty classic for lead poisoning, right? Remember that on exams you may also see like they may give you a picture of a ringed sideroblast, or they may describe other like weird like isolated mononeuropathies. Okay, think about lead poisoning. Okay, and remember that the way you treat lead poisoning is you give like a lead chelator, right? So like calcium EDTA, you can give a DMSA, you can give succimer, you can give BAL. I think that's known as like British anti-leucocyte or something weird like that. Basically, right, if you check a child's blood lead levels and it's high, right, usually the next test you do to sort of like confirm is to get a venous lead level, okay, and then you treat with one of those modalities that I've described. Now, the next question says weird lines on the finger plus gallic breath. So gallic breath should hopefully bring some good memories from step one for you in relation to arsenic poisoning. Okay, remember that arsenic poisoning can also cause like some weird like horizontal lines on the fingers. They are known as Mees lines, M-E-E-S, Mees lines. Okay, they're pretty classic for arsenic poisoning. And for those of you that, if you remember from step one, arsenic messes with like lipoic acid in the pyruvate dehydrogenase complex. But that's more step one discussion. Okay. So I think we're done with this really large slide. So I'll encourage you to look up a picture of Mees lines. It's a pretty classic picture that shows up on exams. Okay, the next one. So a child with declining grades and many staring episodes, right? So hopefully this gets you thinking of an absence seizure, okay? Remember, classically, that's associated with like a 3 hertz spike and slow wave activity on EEG. You don't need to be able to recognize it. Just remember the buzzword. And you treat that with ethosuximide. Don't forget that ethosuximide is a T-type calcium channel blocker, not L-type, T-type calcium channel blocker. And remember that absence seizures, right, doesn't show up in adults on MBMEs. If you see an adult question seizures, don't pick absence, right? Absence is a PEDS question 100% of the time, for the most part, on MBMEs. I mean, okay, let's say 99.9%, because you can maybe never truly be sure of something. But I have never seen an absence seizure question that was not in a PEDS patient, okay? And I've done, trust me, I've taken lots of exams in my life, and I've tutored a crap ton of people. Yeah, absence seizures, pediatrics question on MBMEs. Okay. Now, next question says, actually an absence seizure is a kind of generalized seizure. I'll just throw that out there. Okay. So seizures heralded by olfactory hallucinations and a rising sensation in the abdomen, right? It's kind of like weird symptoms, right? The thing is, I would want you to think more of a simple partial seizure. These are basically like weird aurors. Actually, the aurors people have, like aurors, actually a kind of simple partial seizure. Just think of them as like, you know, kind of like weird, bizarre phenomena, like rising sensation in the abdomen, right? Basically, they start in the they originate in the temporal lobe, okay? Very high yield to know that association, that they originate in the temporal lobe, right? And if you kind of remember from previous podcasts, I mean, as you look at the next question that says seizures with sensory motor problems, those are more for like the frontal and parietal cerebral cortex, right? I've sort of talked about this in previous podcasts. Basically, these are seizures that you can kind of localize with like classic neuroanatomical principles, right? So say, for example, a patient has like an infarct in the left MCA. They can have like a right-sided like motor seizure or right-sided sensory seizure, okay? So they have like, basically, they have like seizures that are contralateral to the side of the infarct, okay? That's a pretty classic thing that shows up on exams. It's something you kind of want to keep at the back of your mind, right? And then the next one is a focal post seizure paralysis and weakness. That's something known as a TOTS paralysis, just something you want to remember. It's fine. You generally don't need to treat it. It just goes away after a while. Okay. Usually like hours to days or something like that. Okay, so let's sort of talk about like generalized and focal seizures, okay? Focal seizures, yeah, the seizures that were called partial seizures back in the day, okay? And really, there are two kinds of like partial seizures. And again, I've talked about this in a previous podcast, right? You can have like a simple partial seizure. The new term, I believe, is like focal seizure without loss of awareness, right? You can have like the modal simple partial seizure, right? They may have like muscle rigidity. They may have like this like weird like movement of their arms. Or you may have like a sensory simple partial seizure, right? Those people tend to have like just like bizarre sensations that sort of affect like their hearing or their smell or their taste or like their vision, right? Or they can say, oh, I hear a hissing sound, right? Think about a sensory or simple partial seizure. There's also the autonomic kind of a simple partial seizure, right? Where the people can have like sweating, or they may have like flushing, or like they may have like pupillary dilation, right? So like autonomic symptoms, think about a simple partial seizure with that. Or they may also have like psychic seizures, right? That one rarely shows up on exam, so we're gonna keep on moving from that. And then under the focal seizures, right, so the partial seizures, there's also the complex partial seizures. The other term for complex partial seizure is like a focal seizure with loss of awareness, right? And the thing is, the MBME sort of plays on this trick with people, right? Because people are like, oh, loss of awareness, so that means the person passed out. No, they don't necessarily have to pass out. The thing is that the patient may appear awake in the question, but they're actually not aware of their surroundings, okay? That is still a complex partial seizure, although again, the new name is focal seizure with loss of awareness, right? And the thing is, these seizures, they usually have like, you know, like weird automatisms like chewing or like swallowing or like smacking their lips. Or sometimes you may actually see people like disrobing. Those are all like automatisms that can happen with complex partial seizures. Again, also known as focal seizures with loss of awareness. Okay. They may have like some weird hallucinations, like they may hear like some weird music playing in the background, or they may say that, oh, they feel full in the abdomen, usually in the epigastrium. Think about a complex partial seizure with that. And again, those are both like simple partial seizures, complex partial seizures, they're all examples of partial seizures, right? So focal seizures. So the simple partial kind is the one that's focal without loss of awareness. The complex partial kind is the focal kind that has loss of awareness. And then the generalized seizures, there's many kinds of generalized seizures, right? I already talked about the absence seizures. Don't forget the 3 per second, the 3 hertz of spike and slow wave activity on EEG. They can have like clonic seizures. There's like tonic seizures where they have the predominant symptom is like muscle rigidity, or there's like tonic-clonic seizures. That's like the seizure that everyone knows to be a seizure, right? Where like they're shaking from everywhere and all that stuff. Or they may have like myoclonic seizures, or they can have like drop seizures. Drop seizures are also known as atonic seizures, where a patient like just like loses muscle tone and just boom, drops to the ground. And if you remember from a previous podcast, right, I've talked about there is a weird disease condition that's associated with atonia. So let's assume they tell you a question about a patient that falls asleep at like weird times of the day, and sometimes when they smile or when they hang out with friends, they sort of like just like lose muscle tone and fall to the ground. I hope you're thinking about cataplexy, right? That's a classic finding in narcolepsy, right? Remember, you make that diagnosis with a polysomnography, a sleep study. And those patients tend to have like low levels of hypocretin. I think that's also known as orexin in the cerebrospinal fluid, okay? It's one of those weird things to know. Okay. Now, the next question here is a quick discussion of brain death and syncope. These are just things that you kind of want to know for the neuro shelf. So I'll just, you know, give you like just a few like high yield things relating to like brain death and syncope, right? So, I mean, if your heart stops, you're probably dead, right? But the thing is, brain death is more where like you've basically lost all functions of your entire brain, right, including your brainstem. And the thing is, if you've lost all brain functions, there are certain things you can use to sort of like tell yourself that, okay, maybe this patient is brain dead on an exam, right? So the thing is, they'll essentially have like no brainstem reflexes, right? And the classic ones are like the vestibular ocular reflex may be gone, right? So you can sort of do the caloric test, or you can check like the pupillary light reflex that could also be gone in a brain death. Another thing you can actually do is something known as the apnea test, right? So basically you confirm that those people don't have any kind of like spontaneous respiration after their CO2 has been allowed to rise. Because think about it, if your carbon dioxide has risen to like 70, right? Wait, long before that, your medulla will kick in, right? And force you to breathe, right? If you remember from step one, hypercarbia is a powerful stimulus of respiration, right? So if you're hypercarbic, but you're still not having spontaneous respirations, it means like your brain is no longer responding, okay? That's known as the apnea test. It's actually a pretty good test for the diagnosis of brain death, okay? I mean, an EEG may show like a flat line, but I'll tell you that in general on exams, if they want you to make the diagnosis of brain death and they're trying to get you to pick an answer, think more of like absent brainstem reflexes, like the vestibular ocular reflex. There is one known as the oculocephalic reflex, but think more of the VOR, the vestibular ocular reflex. I think I've described this in one of the neuro podcasts. And then think about like the absence of like a pupillary light reflex, okay? And then the apnea test is a pretty good test as well, which I've already described for the diagnosis of brain death. And then syncope. Syncope is a long topic. There are many kinds of syncope. I mean, there's like a vasovagal syncope, where usually the trigger is like the patient may see like blood, or they may have like a very strong emotional event or like severe pain, and then they pass out. Think about vasovagal syncope. Carotid sinus hypersensitivity, right? It may be a patient that, oh, they're trying to wear ties, or you do like a physical exam where you're auscultating for carotid bruise and then they pass out. Think more about like a carotid sinus hypersensitivity, or you may see like a micturition syncope where the patient is like trying to pee and then they pass out, okay? These are all kinds of like a big kind of syncope known as like reflex syncope, if you may. Okay, so those are kind of like key things you want to keep in mind. And don't forget that vasovagal syncope, you can actually make the diagnosis by doing something known as the tilt table test. Okay, tilt table test. And I mean, some of you may say, like, Divine, how do I recognize a cardiogenic syncope? Cardiogenic syncope, like, there's usually like no real prodrome, right? The patient usually just suddenly like just loses consciousness. They just pass out, no warning, no prodrome. And the thing is, sometimes they may have chest pain with the syncope. And usually in the MBME question, they may tell you that the patient has like risk factors for like vascular disease, right? So they may have like a history of MI or coronary artery disease or stroke or whatever. If you see that, think more about like cardiogenic syncope as the potential cause of the patient's syncope. So I think those are just sort of key things you can sort of like latch onto to help you make the diagnosis pretty much for most cases you'll see on your exam. So let's jump on to the next question. So algorithm for the management of a patient in status epilepticus, and then the anti-epileptic drug with the strongest risk of neurotube defects. I'll just answer the second question right off the bat. Valproic acid is not good. In general, if you can, make a pregnant woman not take valproic acid, do that. Okay, because it has a very high risk of neurotube defects. But while I'm talking about that, on your MBME, they may actually give you a question about a patient that has had seizures for a long time that has been well controlled with valproic acid, right? And then they can tell you that, oh, the patient gets pregnant. And then they stop taking their valproic acid. Or let's say they are taking valproic acid, but they are having like multiple seizures in pregnancy. The thing is, usually the right answer there is actually to continue the anti-epileptic that they're taking. So you may like have to like increase the dose of valproic acid or something. They will try to, and in the question usually they'll say that, oh, these people have tried multiple anti-epileptics and none of them are working. It's only valproic acid that's working really well for the patient. Even if you're worried about neurotube defects, seizures are very fatal to the baby, right? So you want to keep that valproic acid going during pregnancy. Like a right answer may be to like increase the dose or restart the valproic acid. Sometimes they may even tell you that, oh, the drug level is like suboptimal. You want to increase the dose of the drug, right? So that mom does not have seizures during pregnancy. But valproic acid is the anti-epileptic with the worst, highest risk of a neurotube defects. Okay, now, how do you manage status epilepticus? I mean, there are many things you're supposed to do, but I'll say for MBMEs, the key things you want to recognize are that first, you start with lorazepam, okay? You basically start with a benzodiazepine. And then, if that's not doing the trick for the patient, you then jump to the next option, right? You give them like IV, like phenytoin or like fosphenytoin, okay? Usually give two doses. If that doesn't work, you should probably be calling like your friends in neurology and anesthesia at this point, right? You want to go for the nuclear option. You basically sedate them with like a barbiturate, like phenobarbital, okay? And then the next question says, as an aside, involuntary flailing movement of one arm, right? This is hemibalismus, right? This is a subthalamic nucleus lesion, okay? A contralateral subthalamic nucleus lesion, right? So if the patient has involuntary flailing movement of the left hand, think about a right subthalamic nucleus lesion. Okay, and then the next one says, involuntary movements of the jaw with no other neurodeficits relieved with gentle stroking of the jaw. this is just something that you should be able to classically recognize on exams. This is like a focal dystonia, okay? That stroking the jaw, I think there's like a Latin term they use for that stroking to relieve the symptoms. I think is known as a gest, like G-E-S-T-E. Gist antagonist or something like that, like weird stuff. That's a focal dystonia. Really, like it's like a sustained muscle contraction, okay? And again, the classic way it presents on exams is the way I just described it. And really, you can actually treat a focal dystonia by just injecting Botox, like the botulinum toxin, into that muscle group. Remember, the botulinum toxin works by in cleaving snare proteins, right? So you don't release acetylcholine at the neuromuscular junction, okay? Okay, so let's go on to the next slide. So what is going on? So fever, headache, stiff neck, right? Hopefully you know that this is meningitis. In general, you can do a lumbar puncture for meningitis, but before you can do a lumbar puncture on exams, look in the Q-stem. Ask yourself, do they have any signs of increased intracranial pressures? If they do, you need to do a CT scan first before you do the LP, right? Because you don't want to do an LP in a patient that has high CP, they herniate and die. You don't want to do that, right? So if there are no signs of increased ICP on the in the Q-stem, do an LP. If there are signs of increased ICP on your Q-stem, do the CT scan first before you then do an an LP. Okay, next one says sudden onset, severe headache, and neck stiffness, right? So I'm asking for the diagnosis here and diagnostic testing, right? So hopefully you're not thinking meningitis with this. Hopefully you're thinking more of a subarachnoid hemorrhage, okay? So subarachnoid hemorrhage can actually present with nuchal rigidity, okay? So don't get dinged by that on an exam. So this is a subarachnoid hemorrhage, right? And again, obviously you make the diagnosis with a CT, a non-contrast CT scan of the head. And then you also do, if that's negative, you can jump to a lumbar puncture to look for xanthochromia. And I guess with this question, I kind of want to highlight a useful test-taking principle that has helped me like many times to eliminate answers on exams, right? So it's differentiating between a problem that is acute and a problem that is like chronic, right? So think about this question I just talked about, sudden onset severe headache, right? You cannot like be sort of like walking on the street and boom, you get meningitis. No, it doesn't happen that way. It'll be something that sort of like develops over hours, right? But if a patient has like sudden onset, worst headache of their life, that's a more sinister acute problem, right? You want to think more about like a brain bleed, like a subarachnoid hemorrhage with that. So the thing is, when you're analyzing exam answers, divide them. If the question is giving you an acute problem, an answer choice that is like a chronic issue is probably not the correct answer, right? That's like a very useful test-taking strategy that helps me a ton on many of these MBME questions and also, I guess, in your world. Okay, now next question is a triad, right? So like fever, headache, and focal neurologic deficits. This is the classic triad. This is almost always the way it presents on exams. You're thinking more of about a brain abscess. Okay, so fever, headache, neurologic deficits. Think about a brain abscess. You can make the diagnosis with like a brain MRI. Don't choose CT scan. Do an MRI. And you want to, you know, give broad spectrum antibiotics. Use imaging to aspirate the abscess. That's usually done by the neurosurgery people. Okay. And then the next one says recent history of otitis media with focal neurologic deficits and papilledema on a fundoscopic exam. This is also potentially a brain abscess. Okay. So same treatment as I already described, right? And then just, I guess, while we're on this topic, if you see the triad of a patient that has a history of being an IV drug user and they have fever, and then they tell you in the question that, oh, they have back pain and they have like some weird neurodeficits, think about a spinal epidural abscess, okay? Treatment is the same as a brain abscess, right? So you give broad-spectrum antibiotics, and if you can drain it, you try to drain it. Again, call your neurosurgery folks to help you with that. Okay, and then the next question says ataxia, urinary incontinence, and dementia. Hopefully this gets you thinking about like wacky, wet, and wobbly. This is normal pressure hydrocephalus, just something you need to recognize. You treat it by decreasing the ICP, right? So you can put like a VP shunt in the brain or something like that. And then the final one here, elderly patient, mini mental status exam of 20 over 30 with no past neurological history to Benadryl last night, right? So on your exam, you're not going to see Benadryl. You're going to see diphenhydramine, okay? But this should hopefully get you thinking about delirium, okay? Remember that diphenhydramine has powerful anticholinergic activity. In fact, you've probably heard this warning like more times than you care to remember in med school. Don't give drugs with anticholinergic activity to the elderly, right? So like diphenhydramine, all these many of these first generation antihistamines, they have anticholinergic activity. Drugs that are used for like urinary incontinence, because guess what? Who gets urinary incontinence? Old people, right? So drugs like oxybutynin, tolterodine, darphenazin, sulfenazine, trospium, those are all like muscarinic receptor antagonists, okay? They can cause delirium in the elderly. Okay, so they can give you a question about a patient that has like urge incontinence and then they act delirious, okay? Think about those drugs as potential inciting agents. Okay. And then the next question, kind of dementia. So the first one, in fact, I guess let me just sort of say it right off the bat. I'm basically going to answer the questions on this slide and the next slide together. Okay. So the first one is MMSE 19 over 30 plus difficulty speaking plus inability to perform ADLs, right? So activities of daily living, right? So I'm asking for the diagnosis. How do you manage this? What's the APOE association? It's just one of those bizarre things that you love to throw on exams. So For this patient, I'm talking about Alzheimer's disease, okay? And I guess one thing I'll say is this is actually like a low yield factoid, but it's a weird thing that may show up on an exam. Before you formally make the diagnosis of Alzheimer's, you actually need to do some kind of brain imaging. Usually you do like an MRI, right? Usually you do an MRI. Sometimes you can do a CAT scan, a CT scan, or you can do like SPECT imaging, but usually you do an MRI, okay? And please don't forget that Down syndrome has an association with Alzheimer's, right? Because remember that the amyloid precursor protein is on chromosome 21. If you have Downs, you have trisomy 21, so you have three copies, right? So patients with Downs tend to get like early onset Alzheimer's, right? So like Alzheimer's in their 40s, for example. And Alzheimer's, right? If you do like a brain biopsy, let's say when the patient is dead, classic things you'll see is, right, you can see like a senile plaque, right? Those are basically like extracellular deposits of like amyloid in the brain, right? You can see like neurofibrillary tangles. As against the senile plaques that are extracellular, the neurofibrillary tangles are actually intracellular, okay? They are made of like hyperphosphorylated tau protein. Okay, and the thing is, remember, in Alzheimer's, in general, if you want to treat, you give a drug that has a procholinergic activity, right? So you give like your acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, and you don't, like on the exam, if they put pyridostigmine as a treatment for Alzheimer's, don't choose that, even if it's an acetylcholinesterase inhibitor. You want to choose one of three drugs, right? So like donepezil, galantamine, or rivastigmine. They are all acetylcholinesterase inhibitors. They boost your levels of acetylcholine and they treat Alzheimer's because Alzheimer's is associated with low levels of acetylcholine. In fact, on exams, classically the neuro shelf and the psych shelf, they love to test neuroanatomical associations with certain diseases. I'll encourage you, if you have the chance, look at one of the last two slides of my psych video review. I sort of catalog those associations for you, but for Alzheimer's, which is, I guess, what we really care about in this podcast, for Alzheimer's, I told you that there are low levels of acetylcholine in Alzheimer's, right? That's why you give acetylcholinesterase inhibitors to treat. So the thing is, one nice way they can test the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's on your exam is they can tell you that, oh, is there a part of the brain that is not functional, it's Alzheimer's? Think about the basal nucleus of Meynert. Remember, the basal nucleus of Meynert is where acetylcholine is produced in the brain. And if you actually think about acetylcholine synthesis has a rate-limiting enzyme. The rate-limiting enzyme of acetylcholine synthesis, I believe, is a choline acetyltransferase. Okay? If you have mutations in that enzyme or dysfunction of that enzyme, that's potentially behind the pathophysiology of Alzheimer's disease. So just one of those weird things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Okay. So, and Alzheimer's, I mean, I said you can give a cholinesterase inhibitor, donepezil, galantamine, rivastigmine. There's one other drug known as tacrine, but that's rarely used. I don't know if it's been banned or something, but don't choose tacrine on exams. If you have those other options like donepezil, galantamine, rivastigmine, I should probably look that up some more. But donepezil, galantamine, rivastigmine are your go-to drugs. You can also use memantine. That's like an NMDA receptor antagonist. Okay. So next question here says, so kind of dementia in a patient that has like Parkinsonian features. They have like visual hallucinations and syncopal episodes. Think about Lewy body dementia. That's a pretty classic presentation there. And then the next one says dementia plus choriform movements. And for this, I actually need the pathophys. I need the findings on imaging and the treatment. So this hopefully gets you thinking about Huntington's disease, right? Huntington's chorea. Remember, it's a trinucleotide repeat disorder, right? And like most trinucleotide repeat disorders, not all, most, is inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion, right? And the trinucleotide repeat here is a CAG, okay? Like CAG repeats on chromosome 4. Okay, and classically, if you do imaging in a patient that has Huntington's, right, you will classically find like atrophy of the caudate nucleus. Remember, it's right smacked up against the lateral ventricles. And Huntington's disease, I really don't have the time to go into describing mechanisms. I don't know if I've done in a previous podcast or something, but Huntington's disease, I think of it as a high dopamine disorder, like a disorder that is associated with like high levels of dopamine at least initially in the disease, right? So you treat it with like a dopamine antagonist. You can give like haloperidol, or you can give something that inhibits the transporter that basically like packages dopamine in vesicles before you dump it in the synapse. That transporter, I believe, is known as VMAT. You can inhibit it with a drug known as tetrabenazine, okay? Or like, tetrabenazine is probably the big one you want to remember for tests. Okay, now, the next one says mild dementia plus difficulty speaking plus inappropriate behavior plus knife's edge appearance on brain imaging. Hopefully, this gets you thinking about Pick's disease, right? So like frontotemporal dementia. That's pretty much all you need to know about that. And then the next one says stepwise deterioration in cognitive function with neurodeficits. This is vascular dementia. And by stepwise decline in neurologic function, here's how it will present on an exam. They'll basically give you a question about a patient that is like, oh, you can, because, I mean, think about it. A patient that has dementia, right, they don't say, oh, on December 7, 1992, I started having troubles remembering stuff. No, they're not. They would just sort of say like, yeah, dog, over the last like couple of months, couple of years, I don't seem to be remembering stuff very well anymore, right? Vascular dementia is more like, oh, they will see in the question like, oh, 5 years ago, this patient started being forgetful. 4 years ago, this patient started having so and so issue, right? Usually it's like dementia in the setting of neurologic deficits, and you can almost always pinpoint like an exact time where the symptoms started, like specific symptoms started. That's what's the stepwise decline in neurologic function. Think about a vascular dementia with that. And really, vascular dementia, usually on exams, they will give it as a question in a patient that has like, again, risk factors like hyperlipidemia, coronary artery disease, history of stroke, blah, blah, blah. Okay, and again, there's not much you can do to treat, but you can give like the drugs you give for Alzheimer's, the cholinesterase inhibitors like donepezil. Okay, so next question says rapidly, so let's say over like a 6 week period, for example, rapidly progressive dementia in a patient that got a corneal transplant a year ago with, and this patient also has myoclonus on physical exam. This is the bad disease. There's no treatment. This patient is in big trouble. This is Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease. Okay, remember that in the CSF they will have elevated levels of the 14-3-3 protein. It's a very high yield thing to know for exams. And then this last one, I've talked about it again, but again, I'm not repeating it for funsies. It's kind of high yield to know this, right? So urinary incontinence plus gait problems. Think about normal pressure hydrocephalus. Okay, and early onset Alzheimer's, again, remember that it's in patients that have Down syndrome, right? So like trisomy 21. And if you're thinking about ApoE with Alzheimer's, don't forget that if you have like the ApoE4 polymorphism, that actually renders you susceptible to Alzheimer's versus the ApoE2 polymorphism that is actually like a protective factor against Alzheimer's. So the lower number is protective, the higher number is renders you susceptible to Alzheimer's. Okay, so ApoE4, Alzheimer's, ApoE2 protective, ApoE4 renders you susceptible. Okay, and I think that's all I need to talk about on this slide. So let's jump to the next one, right? So next one says inability to calculate plus left-right disorientation. You want to think about like a parietal lobe lesion, okay? And I guess let's sort of talk about these parietal lobe lesions because they're kind of high yield to know for exams, right? So you can screw up your dominant parietal lobe or your non-dominant parietal lobe, right? If you screw up your dominant parietal lobe, that's something known as Gerstmann syndrome, okay? Basically, these people will not be able to calculate. They can't do math, right? So acalculia, right? They'll have problems writing, right? So they'll have like agraphia, and they'll also kind of have trouble telling like left from right, okay? Like left-right disorientation. Think about a dominant parietal lobe lesion. That's known as Gerstmann syndrome. And then if you think more about neglect, think more about a non-dominant parietal lobe lesion. Okay, so remember that most people use their right hands, right? And the right side of your body is controlled by the left side of your brain, right? So most people are left parietal lobe dominant, right? So if you have a lesion of your left parietal lobe, which is like your dominant parietal lobe, okay, then you have Gerstmann syndrome and all those symptoms I described. But if you have like a lesion of your right parietal lobe, which is your non-dominant parietal lobe, you have like neglect, right? So they can like basically not pay attention to one side of their body, like they can like brush one side of their teeth, you know, like just neglect, right? You kind of know how that presents. Okay, wow, we're on 38 minutes already. Okay, let's keep going. Next slide says high yield anti-epileptic drug side effects. So like valproate, carbamazepine, or oxcarbazepine, and also phenytoin. These ones, they're kind of high yield, just very few things you need to know. Valproic acid, I already said, highest risk of neural tube defects. Now, very high yield to know for your neuron, your side shelf, that valproic acid is hepatotoxic, okay? It's bad for the liver. And then your carbamazepine slash, I guess, oxcarbazepine, think about agranulocytosis. So they are teratogens, right? So you don't give them to pregnant women. They can also cause SIDH. Remember, SIDH is a cause of euvolemic hyposmolar hyponatremia. Remember, I talked about this in the one of the medicine videos. And right, so basically these patients will have like low serum osmolarity and high urine osmolality, okay? And then again, it's a teratogen. And then phenytoin can cause neural tube defects. It can cause arrhythmias. Actually, phenytoin is actually a class 1b antiarrhythmic. If you really dig down, drill down on its pharmacology, it's basically a class 1b antiarrhythmic. So it can actually cause arrhythmias. It's a teratogen. It can actually cause like some weird visual issues. So if they usually write it as like a nondescript question on exams, right? So like a patient has like weird visual issues, like nystagmus, you know, like just like weird stuff. Think about phenytoin toxicity. In fact, that's like usually like a telltale sign of phenytoin toxicity, like just weird visual problems. And then don't forget, you can actually measure like a blood phenytoin level to see if like it's like therapeutic, subtherapeutic, or like in a toxic range, right? And then don't forget from step one, your fetal hydantoin syndrome. This can show up on a Pete shelf as well. Usually they have like microcephaly, like a small head. They'll have like a flat nasal bridge. They can have like cleft lip and palate. Those things all go along with fetal hydantoin syndrome. Remember, hydantoin kind of sounds like phenytoin, right? So it's kind of easy to remember that way. And then also very high yield to know that phenytoin can cause gingival hyperplasia. And then there's also this weird immunosuppressant that causes gingival hyperplasia. I believe that's a cyclosporin. Yeah, cyclosporin can cause a gingival hyperplasia as well, but also phenytoin can. And then don't forget that phenytoin can cause like dermatologic issues like Steven-Johnson syndrome. And also kind of a weird one to know, this is probably more for step 2 CK and step 3, and I guess step 1 if you're listening to this podcast. Drug-induced lupus. Phenytoin can cause drug-induced lupus, just like hydralazine and sulfonamides and isoniazide, and I believe etanercept. Okay, don't forget the association with antihistona antibodies. Okay, next question here. 15-year-old with hand with let me correct this right now so I don't forget, with jerky hand movements in the morning and occasional generalized tonic-clonic seizures. This is just a weird one you want to be able to remember. This is like juvenile myoclonic epilepsy. That's literally all you need to know. It's just something you want to be able to recognize on a test. Okay. Now, this next one is kind of bizarre, but it's actually very high yield for exams. Recurrent seizures plus a contralateral homonymous hemianopsia plus problems understanding speech. So think about like a Wernicke's aphasia, if you may. Recurrent nosebleeds, positive fecal occult blood test. This is just a weird thing that you want to be able to recognize. This is a disease known as hereditary hemorrhagic telangiectasia. You probably know it as Osler-Weber-Rondeau disease. It's inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. Classically on exams, it presents with like telangiectasias. Classically, it's on the lips. So don't get fooled by Peutz-Jeghers syndrome. Because remember, Peutz-Jeghers syndrome can also cause like black lip lesions, if you may. But if they give you a picture of like those black lip lesions, but they tell you that this patient has like bleeding and they have like a positive fecal occult blood test, you probably want to think more about HHT, okay? Which is also, again, known as Osler-Weber-Rondeau syndrome, okay? So, again, it's classically on exams, presented with like telangiectasias, and they may also form like AVMs, right? So like AV malformations in like multiple organs, right? So in the example I'm giving in this question, this patient has the AVM in the brain, okay? And if you want to be a little more specific in the question, they have like the AVM in the temporal lobe. Okay, AVMs, usually you can see them pretty well on imaging with like an MRI. They actually tend to have like weird dystrophic calcifications within them. Okay, if you see that, again, if you see those cluster findings, think about Osler-Weber-Rondeau syndrome. Okay, now the next one, again, another bizarre presentation, right? So sudden onset of redness in the eye plus bulging eyes plus a humming sound on auscultation of the skull plus a visual acuity of like 20 over 100 in the affected eye, right? So again, this is just a weird thing you want to be able to recognize on your exam. This is in fact, instead of the humming sound, you could say like, oh, you auscultate the skull or even like the eye, like you put a stethoscope literally over the eye or like over the skull and you hear like a brewery. You want to think about something known as like a carotid cavernous fistula. It's super rare, it's super weird, but it's essentially an AVM. And again, I'm putting this here because I talked about AVMs with Osler-Weber-Rondeau. It's basically an AVM, but you'll find it more in the cavernous sinus. Remember, there are many veins in the cavernous sinus, right? So you can actually have AVMs in the cavernous sinus, and that can cause a carotid or cavernous fistula. Because remember, your carotid arteries actually run through your cavernous sinus, and there are like some veins and like cerebral sinuses that again run through the cavernous sinus. Okay, so if you have an AVM in the cavernous sinus, that can begin to compress all the like surrounding structures, and that can cause lots and lots and lots of problems. Okay, so again, it's just one of those bizarre things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Usually, you make the diagnosis by doing like an MRI, you can do like an MR angiography, and really the treatment is surgery. Okay, so now that we're done with that, let's go on to the next slide. Okay, so 12-year-old male that stands from a seated position by moving his hands over his legs, right? Here I'm asking for the diagnosis, the pathophys, and the less severe form of the disease, right? So hopefully this gets you thinking about Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Okay, remember it's an X-linked disorder, so it will show up in boys on tests, right? And the pathophys involves like a dystrophin gene mutation. Dystrophin is an important cytoskeletal protein, right? So you basically have issues anchoring the cytoskeleton within a skeletal myocyte, right? So that's the pathophys behind the Duchenne muscular dystrophy. And unfortunately, many of these kids, they die like in their teenage years or like early 20s. I mean, you try to give them like high nutritional support. Many of them become wheelchair bound pretty early. It's just a pretty unfortunate disease, but thankfully it's pretty rare. Although it's the most common kind of muscular dystrophy. DMD is the most common kind of muscular dystrophy. And then the less severe kind of muscular dystrophy is like the Becker muscular dystrophy. Okay, it's less severe. And really the pathophys here is that you have like problems with dystrophin. So you have like a mutation in dystrophin, literally, just like DMD. It's just the mutated dystrophin you form has like some function left. Okay, these kids versus those that with Duchenne's that die like in their early 20s or in their teenage years, kids with Becker's can actually live to like old age. Many of them live to like their 50s and whatnot. Okay, so that's I guess a less severe phenotype, if you may. But again, it's also X-linked, so it will only show up in boys on your tests. A girl cannot get Duchenne muscular dystrophy or Becker muscular dystrophy on an MBME exam. Again, I just threw that out there. Now, the next question says a kid that is hypotonic at birth, and then they tell you that the pediatrician, this is like classic exam presentation here, pediatrician has trouble releasing his grip from the kid's mom during a three-month well child check. Or they may present this as well on an exam as like an older male that has like balding, like premature balding, right? I mean, you probably shouldn't be bald at the age of 25, right? If you see like premature balding on an MBME, you want to think about myotonic dystrophy. Remember, it's a trinucleotide repeat disorder. I believe it's a CTG, trinucleotide repeat. Also, autosomal dominant inheritance. And don't forget the gene mutation, right? It's like a DMPK gene mutation. There's also this weird gene, like the CNBP gene, that can also be a mutated gene in myotonic dystrophy. And again, don't forget autosomal dominant inheritance. It's a kind of muscular dystrophy. But unlike DMD and BMD that are inherited in an X-linked fashion, myotonic dystrophy is inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. And then the next one says, 18-year-old male presents with a chief complaint of facial weakness, okay, and upper extremity weakness that have progressively worsened over the past 18 months, okay? So I'm asking for the diagnosis, the inheritance, and the weird demographic exception. It's not really weird, but I think it's just something high yield to sort of talk about, right? So this patient has problems in the face, and then they have problems in the upper extremities, right? Remember, the scapula is kind of around the upper extremities. I'm using this to give you a hint, right? This is something known as a facioscapulohumeral dystrophy. So facioscapulohumeral dystrophy. It's a kind of muscular dystrophy. And the weird thing about it is it kind of shows up like in the initial presentation usually is in like teenage years. And again, facial, right? Problems with the face, scapulohumeral, right? So problems with the upper extremities. That's kind of a nice way to remember that. And it's also inherited in an autosomal dominant fashion. And it actually affects boys and girls, right? So like Duchenne muscular dystrophy, Becker muscular dystrophy affects only boys on exams. But myotonic dystrophy can affect boys and girls, but usually on MBMEs it's boys. But facioscapulohumeral dystrophy actually affects both boys and girls on MBME exams. Okay, again, that's kind of a nice distinction from like Duchenne's and Becker's muscular dystrophy. Okay, now, quick discussion of the proximal muscle weakness disorders, right? So hopefully you're thinking about like poly and dermatomyositis. I've talked about these extensively in my medicine video, but I'll just give you like the Cliff's Notes version for your neuro shelf. Basically, these disorders, I guess one other thing I guess I could kind of talk about is inclusion body myositis. That's another weird one that may occasionally pop up on exams. The thing is, poly and dermatomyositis, they are like inflammatory myopathies, if you may, right? So the problem is at the level of muscle. They usually present on exams with like proximal muscle weakness, right? So they may tell you like, oh, the patient has trouble like combing their hair or rising from a chair, right? Those are just all indications of like proximal muscle weakness. Contrast that with inclusion body myositis, usually is like can have like both proximal and distal muscle weakness. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, in inclusion body myositis, the distal muscle weakness usually shows up first before the proximal muscle weakness. And in contrast with poly and dermatomyositis that tend to be symmetric, right? So like symmetric proximal muscle weakness, inclusion body myositis is usually asymmetric. It usually presents as an asymmetric proximal muscular weakness. In fact, for inclusion body myositis, they may tell you on exams that, oh, initially before they had the proximal muscle weakness, like their finger flexors or like their forearm flexors or like their knee extensors were kind of like all screwed up. Think more about inclusion body myositis if those were the first things that kind of show up. Again, the distal muscle weakness showing up before the proximal muscle weakness, right? And really the way you treat... Well, I guess I can sort of talk about some more things. For polydermatomyositis, don't forget your autoantibodies, right? So like your anti-JO1, anti-MI2. There's another one known as anti-signal recognition particle antibodies, right? Those are classic antibodies in poly and dermatomyositis. And really the way you make the diagnosis of these disorders is you check the creatine kinase first, right? So the creatine kinase will be elevated on exams, okay? If the creatine kinase is normal on an exam, those patients don't have an inflammatory myopathy. I'm just going to throw that out there. So you check the creatine kinase, and then after that, you do an MRI of the muscle, okay? You may say, oh, Divine, come on, it's a muscle biopsy. Muscle biopsy is no longer the diagnostic test for the inflammatory myopathies. You screen with the creatine kinase level, and then you do an MRI of the muscle. If the muscle MRI is equivocal, then you can jump to doing a muscle biopsy. Because, I mean, obviously, a muscle biopsy will be like a gold standard diagnostic test. Okay, and don't forget, right, unlike polymyositis, dermatomyositis will show up with dermatologic findings on an exam. That's why it's called dermatomyositis, right? So you may show up with like the raccoon eyes, you may show up with the Gautran's papules, you may show up with like the Shaw sign, right, where you have like a V-shaped like erythema, like around your neck or like your chest or like your upper back, right? And don't forget that poly and dermatomyositis, they may actually be like a presentation. They may be a paraneoplastic phenomenon in the setting of lung cancer. So usually, if a patient has poly or dermatomyositis, you usually try to do some kind of chest imaging to rule out like some kind of malignancy, usually lung cancer. Usually they also scan like the abdomen to make sure they don't have like a visceral malignancy going on. Let's see, what else do I want to say? Poly dermatomyositis, you can treat them with steroids. Inclusion body myositis usually does not respond to steroids. And polymyositis, right, it's classically more in adults versus a dermatomyositis that can show up in adults but can also show up in kids. Yeah, polymyositis is like super, 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 super rare in kids. Polymyositis is a lot more common in adults, right? So those are just, again, weird high-yield things you want to keep at the back of your mind. Okay, now let's go on to the next slide. So quick discussion of the high yield toxidromes. Okay, so let's talk about this real quick. I'm gonna try to keep this podcast below an hour. Let's see how that goes, right? So a cholinergic toxidrome, excuse me, this may show up like in the context of like nerve gas on an exam, right? Or organophosphate poisoning, right? And remember, your nerve gases could have like weird names. They usually start with S, like sarin, soman on exams. Really though, the way we'll present is you'll be leaky from everywhere, right? So like diarrhea, rhinorrhea, sweating. They'll also, because it's a cholinergic toxidrome, they'll tend to have like papillary meiosis. You want to treat this by basically blocking the acetylcholine receptors, right? Because you have too much acetylcholine going on. Because organophosphates, right? Remember, they inhibit, or nerve gas, remember, they inhibit acetylcholinesterase. So that boosts your levels of acetylcholine, right? So you can treat those by giving atropine to block muscarinic receptors. And then you can also give prelidoxime, right? To regenerate the acetylcholinesterase that's kind of like dead. I sort of think of it as resurrecting acetylcholinesterase from the dead. Okay, you give prelidoxime to make that resurrection happen. Okay, and then for an anticholinergic toxidrome, it's kind of the opposite. So they'll have like papillary mydriasis, they'll have like constipation, they will have like flaccid paralysis, and it will be like a symmetric descending flaccid paralysis, right? So think about like botulism, right? If a patient is like infected with botulism, or they're exposed to like the botulinum toxin for some bizarre reason, they'll have like a symmetric descending flaccid paralysis. Contrast that with Guillain-Barré syndrome, right? That presents with a symmetric ascending paralysis. Okay, so symmetric ascending flaccid paralysis without sensory problems. Think about Guillain-Barré syndrome. And please don't forget, I believe I've talked about this in a previous podcast, one of the neuro podcasts. Guillain-Barré syndrome is associated with something known as albuminocytologic dissociation, right? So you'll find very high levels of protein in the CSF, but you don't find an increase the number of cells. Okay, I talked about like what that term albuminocytologic dissociation means in a prior podcast, so I'm gonna keep going. Okay, and then tricyclic antidepressants, it'll be a patient with like a psych history. Classically on exams, it will show up with like weird neurologic deficits. They will have like arrhythmias, and they may even give you an EKG showing like a wide QRS complex. That's a classic presentation there. And really, you want to treat that toxicity with a sodium bicarb. And then cocaine, also known as cocaina. I like that term. Okay, so cocaine, right, it will cause hypertension. On exams, it may present with like perforation of the nasal septum, right? Those patients will tend to have like mydriasis. It may present with like a myocardial infarction on a test. Okay, and the patient's blood pressures are like crazy high, right? Like in the 180s, 200 systolic. Really for cocaine toxicity, remember, you don't want to give a beta blocker, right? Person with a JD after their name will be very happy to come and collect your license and throw you in jail. So don't do that. You don't give beta blockers for cocaine toxicity. You tend to give benzos first. Okay, and then you can actually try to lower the blood pressure like an alpha-1 blocker, like phentolamine, for example. Okay. And then glue slash toluene, right? So like sniffing. This is something usually on exams. The classic presentation will be that you do like urine tox screen and you don't see anything. For that, think about like a patient that's like, you know, like sniffing glue. I mean, there are other things they could sniff as well that sort of contain, like they could sniff glue, they could sniff like gasoline, they could sniff like stuff used for like dry cleaning or like cooking sprays or like toiletries. Basically, glue and all this badness, the big thing they contain is toluene. And classically on exams, right, these patients, they may have like sores or like rashes around like their nose, around their lips. If you see that, think about sniffing glue. And the thing is, toluene can cause a type 1 RTA. It can cause a type 1 renal tubular acidosis. So on exams, it may actually present with like hypokalemia. And in some cases, it may also present with like hypophosphatemia. Okay, those are kind of like weird associations you want to keep at the back of your mind. But the hypokalemia arises because you get like a type 1 RTA, a distal RTA, if you chronically sniff glue. I mean, there's some other like badness that can also happen when you sniff glue. There's something called what's this thing? I read an article about this. It's called like, I think it's like sudden sniffing death syndrome. Because the thing is, one of the reason people sniff glue, right, is it gives you a high. And the high comes because glue sniffing actually causes like this hyperadrenergic response. You have like this massive release of catecholamines, right? So that's what gives you the high. Only problem is that hyperadrenergic response can cause ventricular arrhythmias, classically VFib. Okay, and they can die. Okay, so if you see a patient like sniffing weird stuff and then they suddenly die, think about a sudden sniffing death syndrome. Okay, usually the arrhythmia that kills them is VFib, right? So if you have friends that sniff stuff, tell them to stop doing that, right? It's something that can kill them pretty quickly. Okay, next one is opioids, right? So opioids will present with pinpoint pupils, right? So like papillary meiosis and respiratory depression, right? So the respiratory will be like 5 or 6 on an exam. Remember, the way you treat that is with you give naloxone, right? If you get an exam question that gives you naloxone and naltrexone as answer choices, don't pick naltrexone. Your patient could be dead before the naltrexone kicks in. Give naloxone. Naloxone is the treatment of choice for opioid toxicity. And opioid withdrawal is not life-threatening, so you really don't give anything for that. What other thing do I want to say about opioids? Let's see. And opioids, yeah, okay, so I guess opioids, right? So you get meiosis, and you actually never get tolerant to like the meiosis and constipation that arises with opioids. I remember opioids cause constipation, right? I mean, if you've ever taken Imodium for diarrhea, Imodium is basically loperamide. Loperamide is an opioid, right? So you use the constipation side effect to treat the diarrhea. And then your benzodiazepines, right? So your benzos, right? They can cause respiratory depression, but you have like normal papillary findings, right? You won't see the pinpoint pupils that you find with opioids, right? So if you see respiratory depression and a decreased, respiratory depression and papillary meiosis, think opioids. If you see respiratory depression and no papillary meiosis, think more about a benzo or a barbiturate. And remember, you can treat benzos toxicity with a flumazenil, okay? Barbiturates cannot be reversed with flumazenil. If you have barbiturate toxicity, all the best. And actually, while I'm on this, remember that flumazenil can also reverse those toxicity of the Z drugs that are used for insomnia, right? So like zolpidem, zaleplon, and ezobiclone. Again, I apologize for all the ums and ahs. Again, talking about this basically off the top of my head. Okay, now LSD. LSD, right, causes flashbacks, like intensified experiences. PCP, right? PCP on an exam will be a patient that is like Superman, basically, right? They'll push like security guards down. They want to jump off the top of a building. They'll be like hyper violent. Think about PCP with that. And they'll usually have like nystagmus, like a horizontal and vertical nystagmus on an MBME question. And then meth, right? If you have like a busted up mouth, like bad dental hygiene, patient is like super hungry. They have like redness of their eyes. So like conjunctival injection, that's the $5 word. Or if they have hyperreflexia, you want to think about methotrexate, and you really don't need to treat that. And then opioid prep gone bad, I'm thinking more about Parkinsonism. Remember, if you prepare opioids wrong, right, you shouldn't take opioids in the first place. But if you prepare opioids wrong, you can make a MPTP. MPTP has the nice added side effect of destroying the substantia nigra, right? So that can cause Parkinsonism, right? So classically on an exam, and this can show up like on a neuro or psych exam, they may describe it as a patient that took drugs at a party, and then they have like mutism, right? So they kind of like stay still in their chairs, they don't move nothing. Think about Parkinsonism from like bad opioids, right, that contains like MPTP. Okay, so let's go on to the last slide. So the last slide says, what is the next best step in the management of a seizing patient with small cell lung cancer with a sodium of 115? Right, I just put the scenario here because this is the one time you give hypertonic saline on any exam, on any MBME. You never, in fact, I will say in general, never pick hypertonic saline as an answer. This is the one exception. If a patient has like profound hyponatremia, their sodium is less than 120 and they're seizing, then you give 3% saline, hypertonic saline for that purpose. But once their sodium is raised to like 120 or like 122 or thereabouts, stop the hypertonic saline and switch back to normal saline. Hypertonic saline can cause, so from high to low, the brain will blow. That can cause like profound cerebral edema and like herniation, right? And you obviously don't want that. Now, next one says too high with electrolyte imbalances that could cause seizures in the infant of a diabetic mother, right? So like if you're an infant of a diabetic mother, you have the infant will have a ton of glucose in their serum. So they'll have a ton of insulin, right? While they're in utero, right? So they'll have like a ton of glucose. So that will cause the fetus to secrete a ton of insulin, right? But when you extract that baby from mom, when the baby is delivered, right? Well, that high source of glucose is gone. Right, you're now out of mom's body. That high source of glucose is gone, but the pancreatic islet cells may not get the message, and they may still be secreting a ton of insulin. Right, so those infants of diabetic mothers, they can actually get hypoglycemic seizures. Okay, they can also have like hypocalcemic seizures. I don't really know the mechanism behind that. And I guess while I'm on this, don't forget, right, that hypocalcemia with seizures, right, can be a presentation of the George syndrome on an exam. Also, like a kid with like vitamin D deficiency, right? So they may show you like a picture of like a rachitic rosary, like an African American, or a patient that like lives in a place that has like no sunlight, or I guess a radiologist, they could all get like vitamin D deficiency that can cause hypocalcemia, and they could get a seizure with that. Okay, so just one of those weird things you want to keep in mind. So I really hope that you've gotten a lot from this series of neuro podcasts. I know taking together they're all kind of long, but really these neuro podcasts, I designed them to be extremely, extremely, extremely comprehensive. I feel like if you know the material in these neuro podcasts and you do like your practice questions, you do the clinical mastery series tests, I really don't see why you cannot do really well on the neuro exam. I mean, I will say that I knew a lot of this material and I did really well on my neuro shelf. I did extremely well on my neuro shelf. Okay. And if you're free, if you have like added time to study, one thing I will say to maybe consider doing is to watch my psych review video. Because the thing is, on the neuro MBME, they put up some psych questions there. My psych review video, I think, is like an hour and a half. Okay, so it's just something you can watch. There are slides for it. And that will potentially help you get like the psych questions that he put on the neuro shelf. Okay, so just again a weird thing to keep in mind. And then as I round up, I offer tutoring for the USMLE step 1 through 3 exams and shelf exams and like medical school coursework basically. So if you have any friends that need tutoring in those areas, don't forget to send me an email, divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com. And if you have any feedback on the videos or any questions or any concerns, please don't be afraid to reach out. I'll be more than happy to help. So I am sorry I did not meet my goal of keeping this under an hour. It's like 68 minutes, but I wish you a wonderful day and God bless and have a wonderful week. And I hope Manchester United wins their game tomorrow against Juventus. Okay, bye for now. Thank you.